Hi there and welcome along to this racing postcast. It's Monday the 7th of September. It's St Ledger and Irish Champions weekend coming up this weekend, but we also had some fantastic racing this weekend as well, including the Group 1 Prix de Moulins and the Sprint Cup, and of course Enable winning the September Stakes as well. So we have a bumper show in store for you. I'm Maddie Playle. This week I'm joined by Racing Post betting editor Keith Melrose, Lee Mottershead, a rare appearance from Lee on the show, as well as Paddy Powers, Paul Binfield. And we really do have such a range of topics to discuss today. But I want to start off with a saga that's taken up an awful lot of your time over the past week, Lee. For anyone who's been hiding under a rock, what can you tell us about this Delia Bushell saga and just explain it from the start? What has actually happened here and what do we need to know?
Okay, Maddie. Well, there used to be only one Delia in my life, surnamed Smith, but that has changed hugely over the last week. So, yeah, so last Sunday evening, just as I was about to roast a chicken, I learned that Delia Smith was leaving the Jockey Club immediately. We'd reported the previous
Delia Bushell. You said Delia Smith.
Oh, she did that. Just shows you've been in this, doesn't it? It shows
on,
you. I'm Delia out. Yeah, Delia Bushell been in. Delia Smith was never at the Jockey Club. Delia Bushell was leaving the Jockey Club. So we'd reported that Delia Bushell was at the centre of a formal complaint by a member of her senior executive team. That led to an independent barrister being brought into the Jockey Club to investigate that matter. I learned last Sunday evening that the outcome had been that Delia Bushell was leaving the Jockey Club with immediate effect. And so we had in a new sense, it was a very exciting evening, in the sense that you had that side of the story. I was sent Delia Bushell's resignation letter as well, which was hugely explosive. And over the last week or so, I was basically working on a big special report that appeared in Sunday's newspaper, trying to tell the story of Delia Bushell's year at the Jockey Club. It was an enormously turbulent reign. For pretty much all the last 12 months, I've been hearing from people talking about Delia Bushell. Delia Bushell never actually did much talking herself. She hasn't really done any big major sit-down interviews or broadcast interviews, but behind the scenes, she was a hugely active figure, not least in the protracted negotiation to get a new deal with ITV. I think it's generally safe to say that aside from a few cases, and one of the cases Martin Cruddas, I quoted in the report, Delia wasn't particularly warmly received either inside the Jockey Club or outside the Jockey Club. I think for that reason, putting to one side the gross misconduct claims that were upheld by, or a number which were upheld by the barrister and which could now lead to a court case, I think overall, I think it's hard to argue that the right outcome is that Delia Bushell is no longer in that position. Speaking personally, I don't think she was a positive contribution to the sport. I think it will be easier for the sport going on without it. And I think certainly what we've seen in the last few days, which is a very unedifying spectacle of Delia and her former employer, the Jockey Club, really going at each other with hammer and tongs in the press, I think that is a further indication of how disastrous an appointment it was. It makes for very compelling watching in terms of as a news story, but for the sport itself, it's not great, not least because people will see these accusations now that the Jockey Club is a crusty old male-dominated organisation. I genuinely don't think that is the case anymore, and I think it's regrettable that picture is being painted, not least because to some people outside of racing, they hear the words Jockey Club and they will just think that is racing, as opposed to just one commercial body within horse racing. So it's a huge story. It's a story the like of which I've never encountered before, and I sense it has many miles to cover yet before it's over.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people about it over the past week, and their feelings are very much the same, in that it's just an absolutely, you know, unbelievable story, really. I don't want to spend too long sort of delving into this, but as you say, it's not a story that is going to go away anytime soon. In the immediate future, what does it mean for racing now?
Well, I think it means for racing now, the jockey club, for a start, is in a desperately difficult position. I mean, if you take the jockey club's position even before this kicked off, it is British Racing's largest commercial organisation that at the moment has almost nothing to sell. It has, at the moment, no attendances. That will hopefully change at Newmarket later this month. But attendance income, even when crowds start to come back in, is going to be severely impacted. It has no income outside of horse racing, so it's got no corporate, got no conference income. It's got no non-race day income. It's struggling on the sponsorship front, as all race courses are. It hasn't got a sponsor for the Derby. There's one running left of the Grand National with Randox Health as its supporter, as its backer. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that deal ended after this season's race. So commercially, it's in a desperately difficult position right now, but at the same time, it faces an ongoing dispute with its former chief executive. And of course, it is absolutely right that Didier Bushell has the right to pursue this as long as she can. You know, there are two sides to every story. As I've said, I believe it's best for the sport that she's no longer in that job, regardless of the gross misconduct claims. But there are two sides to every story, and she deserves to have every chance of putting a case in every way possible. That means that this will run on and on and on. It's a distraction for the jockey club. The senior steward who appointed us, Sandy Dudgeon, his position has to be in a degree of doubt as well as we go forward. So it is, in all senses, a right mess.
It is. It's a right mess. And I think, you know... Racing is, make no mistake, in a pretty bleak scenario at the minute, and this is just another layer to that. Something that isn't bleak and that we all gained much enjoyment from this weekend was Enable's win in the September Stakes. Okay, it wasn't much of a horse race because she was so superior to her opposition, but that was a box ticked en route to this illustrious third arc bid. And it was a comfortable success. I think we received everything we needed to see from Enable, don't you think, Keith?
Well, yeah. She could only do wrong in that race, and I didn't get much from it, frankly.
No.
You know, people talked about how it's always great to see our great champions on the track, and of course that's true, and getting any appearance from a horse of Enable standing is a positive, but, you know, that's the same thinking behind why Red Rum opened all those betting shops. And didn't tell us much about the arc. So I watched the race, I saw it, there was nothing to be worried about. She's had a race course gallop with the TV cameras in front of her, and now she goes to the arc.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, we didn't learn a great deal from her in this race, other than maybe, do we have anything to worry about with that slow start? Lee, what do you think?
No, I don't think so, Maddie. I mean, I think it was pretty easily explained. She got hit under the chin by one of the stalls handler's ropes as she set off, but she was very quickly in front. And like Keith, I don't think we learned anything except that she's in perfectly good heart and she's where connections wanted to be on the way to the arc. I know there was the debate, wasn't there, beforehand in recent weeks about whether she should have gone to York for that clash with Love in the Yorkshire Oaks. I'm a racing fan like everybody else on this program and listening to this program, and I would have loved to have seen it. At the same time, if I was in their position, I would have done exactly the same thing. This horse was only kept in training to try and win the arc for the third time. It therefore makes absolute sense that they did everything they could to maximize the chances of winning the arc. A dust up with Love on the nose mark probably wouldn't have been helpful in that regard. It means we still have this incredibly enticing Arc de Triomphe to come, this clash between Enable and Love, this potential shot at history, which so nearly happened last year. You sense from talking to DeCorey and Gosden that they really do feel there's a wrong that needs righting. They were so devastated by last year's. I think they realised that had things gone slightly differently, maybe had the race been run differently, maybe had they ridden it differently, we would have had a more favourable outcome. It's going to be a wonderful race. The whole of this year's flat season, just like last year's flat season, has led to that Sunday in October. It's the pivotal moment of this entire campaign. I can't wait, and I actually think she'll win.
You've answered the question I was going to ask fairly straightforwardly there at the end. But there is a lot of different pieces to this arc puzzle, isn't there? I mean, just in that little short clip there, Lee, you didn't mention Stradivarius. We haven't spoken about Gaeth, whether he's going to go. Keith, I mean, let's just, you know, this is a race that we look at week in, week out. What do you think of the arc picture now? If you were to have a bet now, would you still be with whoever you thought was going to win a couple of weeks ago, or...?
Yeah, I've got, well, I've been a fan of Love since he won the Oaks. I think the market has it right, which, you know, I'm glad you didn't come out and say, does Anibal win the Arc? Because my very boring answer was that she is, what, 5-2 to win it, or 3-1, and deserves to be that sort of price. That is her chance of winning the Arc again, because she does have the edge on quite a lot of the competition, but possibly not Love, who's extremely exciting. With Gaeth going, it is something that's going to rumble on. From the little bits and pieces I hear, I don't think he will. Just from what I'm reading in between the lines of what his connections are saying and all that sort of stuff, I wouldn't be taking evens that he'll run in the Arc, which actually might suit Enable, who has demonstrably got a little bit more tactical adaptability than Love, who I sense will always be best when there's a good pace on. So, you know, as a Love backer, there's part of me almost wants Gaeth to run, to be honest. But I still think she is the right favourite ahead of Enable.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll talk about Gaeth a little bit more after later on in the show, given that he is looking increasingly likely to go for the Irish Champion Stakes. What a fantastic race that's going to be. Let's bring Binners into it. Binners, how are you? And let's have a new show on the Arc market.
Well, I'm very well, thank you, Maddie. I kind of agree with Keith. I think it was disappointing at the weekend, the September Stakes, a Group 3 race. We get six runners, we get Enable. Sure, it's great to see her last appearance on a race course. All that would have been better with spectators. That's no one's fault. But a 14-1 on chance wasn't brilliant for the bookies. But let's just hope it's increased enthusiasm for the Arc at the beginning of October. It may well have done. Keith was talking about 3-1 for Love. Well, I'm afraid he can't. He won't be getting that. We're 7-4 favourite.
It was 3-4 Enable. Sorry, 3-1 Enable.
You probably did say 3-1 Enable. I didn't listen properly, Keith. So anyway, we're 7-4 Love. 11-4 Enable. 10-1 Gaeth. And Ra Bihar 10-1. 14 bar. And I quite like, I always like three-year-old fillies in the Arc, so I'm still quite a fan of Ra Bihar or Fancy Blue at this stage.
Interesting. You mentioned Ra Bihar after what Jean-Claude Rouget had to say about her. He really has a lot of belief in that filly, so it'd be interesting to see when she gets properly tested.
About Ra Bihar, she's always been massively well regarded. Yeah, every time she's run, you just got the impression they really, really like her, and she's a good horse.
Yeah, certainly. And the market in the races that she's run has reflected that as well. What about domestically then? Dream of Dreams. He gained his deserved first win in that Betfair Sprint Cup at Haydock. Crazy to think that he'd not yet scored at the very top level, given that he's been second in two of those Royal Ascot showdowns. Can he confirm this form on Champions Day? What do you think, Lee? Because he's been around a long time now, and it was great to see him get his head in front. But can he do it again?
Well, he's been around for a long time, but at the same time, he almost seems like a new Dream of Dreams this year at the age of six. He was obviously gelded prior to this season, and it does seem to have helped him, as does the later start to the campaign. He's only had his three runs this season. You know, he produced his first really blistering performance in the Hungerford Stakes, even though he'd been second to Blue Point and Hello Humes in two editions of the Diamond Jubilee. The Hungerford was one I thought we really looked to have brilliance about him. It wasn't that same brilliance, actually, in his win at Haydock on Saturday, but I thought it was a win that he really deserved. He strikes me now as a much more consistent horse than he was before, pretty dependable, a really high-class sprinter. And for me, as someone that is old and crusty, unlike the Jockey Club Maddie, I think it's lovely to see Sir Michael Stout with a high-class sprinter. You know, this was, I remember sort of growing up watching racing through the 80s, and he had horses like Marwell, Green Desert, Ashdale, really high-class sprinters. That hasn't so much been the case in the last few years. That's just because of horses that you get sent. But he's reminded us that he certainly knows how to train a very good sprinter. And in Dream of Dreams, I think he does have a very good sprinter.
Yeah, he certainly does. And Keith, this was a really interesting tactical race with regards to in behind. We've spoken a lot about these sprinters week in, week out. That's the great thing, isn't it? That they keep on coming back. This was a much better run from Art Power in behind, and a lot of people singled out Golden Horde as a horse to watch going forward. What was your analysis of the race?
Well, you could see the pace was high pre-race, and it looked from first view as though, you know, that near side group that had the pace had the better of it. But, you know, there wasn't much in it when they went past the camera halfway. I think Art Power was very slightly ahead of Golden Horde. And people are marking up Golden Horde above the result because he was the only one to make an impact from that group up the middle of the track. But what was interesting, we'll talk about You Can Glen later, but if you look a furlong and a half, two out, You Can Glen and Golden Horde have come up the same part of the track, and You Can Glen's won the Old Borough Cup. So I'm not particularly convinced by the argument about either the pace or track suiting the stand side any more than you'd think. I don't know what it might be. I had a look. The wind that day was meant to be coming from the west-southwesterly direction and meant to be quite fresh, which at Haydock means it's coming from your left and into. I wonder if that group on the far side got a lot more of the wind exposure than the near side, and maybe that's what caused the issue there. What I was impressed most about Golden Horde is how he travelled. You know, everything in that group was humped before he came off the bridle. And the fact he's not sort of seen out as well as some could be put down to where he was placed on the track all the way throughout. So yeah, he did come out the race looking quite something. Dream of Dreams, I think, at Ascot is going to be suited by the stiff six that they have there, and especially given that Champions Day tends to be on more testing ground. So when it comes to Ascot, I think I would have to be siding with Dream of Dreams again. But I can definitely see circumstances, a speedier six, where Golden Horde and even Art Power to some extent could give him more of a race.
Fascinating that, isn't it? Comparing races with a mile difference in the distance. Great to see Holly Doyle get that second aboard Glenshiel, wasn't it? Her dream season just keeps on going, and that horse is improving relentlessly this year. He's another big winner for Oisin Murphy. Now, of course, he's serving his ban in the run-up to this weekend. Let's bring another horse into it then, because we're talking about different divisions here, and let's go back to the miling division. And Top Rank, he won the Group 3 Betfair Superior Mile from My Oberon and Calusi. He was sent off the favourite, and this horse, he wasn't, I don't know, you could say he was disappointing last time, but he's another who's had a towering reputation, and you feel like connections have really got to the bottom of it here, and he looks a really smart miler going forward, doesn't he, Lee?
Yeah, he absolutely does. And you know, you referred, Manny, to that race at York last time, but you know, that was such a red hot handicap, that 1 mile handicap at the Ebor Festival. It always has been, you know, right back to its days as the Bradford and Bingley. It's always been a really strong race. You know, I think in running third that day, he at least equaled anything he'd done before. He stepped up on that at Haydock, and yeah, I thought there was loads to like about it. You sense he's clearly not the most robust individual, you'd imagine, looking at his profile. He's only had six runs as he enters the autumn of his four-year-old campaign. But there was loads to like about that win at Haydock. James Tate was adamant afterwards that he probably would always want, well, he wouldn't want fast ground. You know, good or soft would be fine for him, which suggests an autumn horse. He still has to find an awful lot to win a Group 1 at the moment. I mean, they're talking about the QE2, as we'll discuss later in the programme. That is going to be a very, very strong QE2. He can't win that on what he's done so far, but he's certainly going to win more races, and you'd imagine if he can stay sound, he'll only get better.
What price did you go for that QE2 for Top Rank winners?
Yeah, well, Maddie, I think Lee's hit it on the head. We went 20 from 25. He was impressive. Well done to James Tate. He was mentioning possibly a Group 2 rather than a Group 1. I assume the Joel Stakes at Newmarket at the end of the month might come into the equation. But listen, if they do throw their hat in the ring at Ascot, he deserves his chance.
And he's the most beautiful specimen, isn't he? He's got a real big chest on him, and I feel like we're only just scratching the surface with him. Keith, what do you think? Do you think he can make an impact at the top level?
I think he does. He might be one of these horses that has to be really well placed to win a Group 1, but I've got no doubt that he can go up from Group 3 to Group 2 and win and do some damage. I still don't quite know what to think of this horse, because I thought at York he looked like a speed miler in the way that he travelled and then sort of was a little bit one-paced when he was asked. And then on Saturday he just really did pick up late on and go away from them. So I'm still feeling him out a little bit, which obviously after he's had 6 runs, that's something that's excusable. But I have no doubt about his class. I think he will win a group two level. And as I say, if maybe you find a race in France or something, you could maybe pick up a Group 1 if you look for a slightly lesser target. But I think that the encouraging thing, as Lee sort of alluded to a little bit, is that, you know, he has got a history of being a fragile horse, but he's run 3 times in 6 weeks now and come through it very well with an improved performance right at the end. So it might be that they have got him to a point now where he can take his racing. And hopefully we will get to see more of him, because he has got the potential to infiltrate the top rank of the milers.
Mm. Yeah, it'll be fascinating to see how he progresses throughout the rest of the season. One of the big handicaps of this weekend was the Old Borough Cup. We've spoken about it. Eucan Glen winning. Did he give a boost to the Ebor form, would you say? He beat Dark Jedo, Diocletian and Rhythmic Intent for Paul Mulrennan and Jim Goldie. Great to see that pairing get a big win. Do we have any other eye catchers from the weekend? Any horses or performances we want to mention? Keith, I'll go to you first. What did you spot this weekend?
Well, yeah, obviously we talked about this race with reference to the Sprint Cup, and I think maybe the way that it looks consistent is that Eucan Glen, it was a modestly run race for a big handicap, to be quite honest, and Eucan Glen's come from the back to go win going away, and I think what happened there is that Mulrennan kept him covered up until very late in the day and then came out and then went on. I think that was maybe what won him it, and contrast that with what Dark Jedi did, which was basically travel up in the middle of the track, exposed all the way up the straight and travelled all over them, and then didn't quite see it out as well as Eucan Glen, but still came clear of the main field. I thought if the sort of theory about what was happening at the track is anywhere remotely correct, Dark Jedi comes out with a lot of credit from that race. And if he was to say go for a November handicap, or maybe is that 3-year-old race being run this year, the mile and a half race, that one, he could be a really interesting horse for one of those. He stays a 6 fine, that's okay, but he is by Kodiak, and I think a 6 is top end for him. A mile and a half in the autumn will be perfectly acceptable, and I think he can run another big race in one of these big handicaps.
Okay. And Lee, you were lucky enough to be at Kempton. Did you spot any horses going under the radar there? We had the Serenia Stakes. That was won by Mighty Gurkha. And there was a really nice story, I thought, that Bullfinch managed to win on that card after, you know, we feared the worst for him in an incident earlier on this season. What did you pick out?
Yeah, I think he's a really progressive horse, isn't he? That was a hot handicap. It's the one that I think normally is the final of the London Mile Series. It's a valuable race. Different sort of race this year, but he won that with plenty in hand. And again, he's a horse that you'd imagine would be breaking through into stakes company. I was really pleased to see Adam McNamara win his first group race on Mighty Gurkha in the Serenia Stakes. He's a good jockey. He's a good guy as well. He's a thinker about racing issues. I like him very much, and pleased to see him win that. And in terms of a bit of an out of the ballpark one, Maddie, to mention for the future from Saturday, I was up early to watch some of the good stuff from Australia. I'm a big Aussie racing fan. The Melbourne Cup is my favourite flat race of the year. I've backed 3 horses so far. Very elegant. Russian Camelot, who will run this weekend. He reappears this weekend. Very elegant, who's already been in fantastic form.
Yep.
And I think could be lethal over 2 miles. And the other one about, again, is another Waller horse. I worship at Chris Waller's altar, really. And he's got one called Shared Ambition, formerly from these parts, who ran in a 1 mile group to the Chelmsford Stakes, was staying on one of the closing stages. He's been given a traditional Aussie Melbourne Cup prep, the Bart Cummings prep, to try and get 10 distance into his legs. before the race comes along. 10,000 metres was always a traditional Bart Cummings prep from Melbourne Cup. That's something with shared ambition. He's not guaranteed to get into the weights directly when they come out this week. He might have to do a bit more before the big day, but I think shared ambition around an eye-catching try, he'll still get 33-1, and I think he's a serious player in the Melbourne Cup.
Fantastic. That certainly is off the grid for a lot of our listeners. Lee went international there and will be going international after this break to talk about the Kentucky Derby. Stay with us.
Paddy Power shops are back open, and with them, the return of a massive racing offer. We're giving best odds guaranteed on singles and multiples. All UK and Irish racing, all shops, all day. Limited time only. Terms and conditions apply. Ask in shops for more details. 18+ BeGambleAware.org.
Now then, Tis the Law was dubbed as the next best thing. He was on track for a rather unique version of the Triple Crown in America this weekend, but it wasn't to be. The Kentucky Derby was won by Authentic for John Velasquez and Bob Baffert. And a rather interesting story this, because he's owned partly by the My Racehorse Syndicate, which allows people all over the world to have a share in a horse running in one of the world's most prestigious races. So it really was quite an excellent story. The Kentucky Derby, Lee, did you stay up and watch it?
I have to be honest, Maddie, I didn't. I say I've been bushelled out this week, and by Saturday night I was flagging. So I was in bed by 10:30, rock and roll Saturday night. But I did watch it first thing on Sunday morning. Clearly, again, a very strange thing watching a Kentucky Derby with almost nobody there, seeing it happen in the flesh. Strange watching it in September as well. But perfectly, obviously, Bob Baffert winning the race. It's just what Bob Baffert does now, wins the Kentucky Derby. I thought Tis the Law went through most of the race looking like he was going to live up to his short odds and his.
Do you think it was just a demanding campaign that got to the bottom of Tis the Law?
I would be lying, Maddie, if I said I would know enough to give you an informed answer on that one. I thought he was a bit keen early on, but in the end, he just seemed to be worried out of it by Authentic. He was given a fantastic ride. And you say it's a fantastic story too, because through this very clever organisation, people can buy a tiny share in the horse. Jack Cantlon, someone I know, and someone plenty of people know from social media, from a great racing family. He was saying he paid just over $200 at the start of the season for a small little share, an insy winsy little share. I mean, it's not going to make him a fortune at all, but it means he can say he is a Kentucky Derby winning owner. And so far, you and I, Maddie, all we can say is we're a part owner of a horse who ran mid-div and an obvious handicap at Utoxeter. Not quite the same as wonderful as Tonka Sky was, but Jack is now a Kentucky Derby winning owner. That's a great thing to be able to put in your CV.
Exactly. And I know with you being such a big fan of Australian racing, there's been some huge success stories of syndicates over there. Just a couple of weeks ago, the name of the horse escapes me now, but a Group One won by a horse who was bought for absolutely nothing. And I think syndicates, we all agree, is something that's going to be the future of ownership in this country. Some fantastic ones already. Keith, any word on the Kentucky Derby won by Authentic before we move on?
Yeah, I got to about a 11:15 on Saturday night. I was about to turn in, and then I realised the Kentucky Derby was on. So I poured another rum and watched it. But with the caveat that all the opinions are formed or flavoured by that last rum. I did think that Tis the Law, I thought he was more sort of outstayed than anything. I watched his previous runs as well. He's a quick strider. I think a mile two is very much top end for him. Obviously, the Belmonte one was 9 furlongs this year. I would imagine he would turn the tables in the Preakness, because apart from anything else, he stayed out wide all the way round. He was possibly the furthest wide of anything round the first bend. And just that extra ground given up, the fact that he might just be topping out at a mile two, I think that was maybe what got him beat on Saturday. And that, yeah, I know that the ones who watch US racing more closely than I are very, very keen on him. And having seen what I've seen on him and piecing that together, I'd say that maybe he will be a really formidable force up to a mile two for the rest of the year.
Don't forget, he won the Travers as well in between all this. So he's clearly a mega talented horse, but it went the way of Authentic. I thought Honor AP was quite unlucky at the start and he ran a good race. So it'll be interesting to see how those three-year-olds develop going forward. Let's talk about the Prix de Moulin now then. It was won by Persian King. Another really fascinating contest, this, wasn't it, from a tactical perspective. Persian King and Circus Maximus, they sort of broke away from the pack, and then Pinatubo, who was covered up by James Doyle, stormed home in the final furlong, but he couldn't get to the winner. He's got the options of the Champion Stakes and the Arc now, but I think just from an analysis point of view, this was really interesting. Did the best horse win, do we think, Keith?
Did the best horse win? The best miler probably didn't win. Pinatubo would be the best miler in that field. And I think what happened in that race was obviously Circus Maximus and Persian King have gone off. Persian King's got a lead all the way through. Pinatubo wanted to be held up. And the three horses he wanted to get cover from all missed the break to varying degrees, which exacerbated how far back off the pace they were. So I think that's probably come into it a little bit as well. I think obviously it's pretty clear that James Doyle did leave it a bit longer than he should have. And that he'd like that one back. But Persian King, I think that's probably not the most interesting thing about it. I think it's Pinatubo for one. I think he's going to win the Breeders' Cup Mile. The horse that picks up like he does is going to absolutely revel in these American mile races on those tight little inside turf tracks. But Persian King is I think a more interesting one here. We've got a horse here who's always looked, he's always been seen as the next big thing out of France, hasn't he, Persian King? And after winning the Poulain last year, you know, he got beat by Sot Sass, but I watched on Saturday and I thought, this horse looks like it'll stay a mile two, no problem. I watched the Jockey Club back from last year again when he was second to Sot Sass, and he didn't feel for stamina that day. Sot Sass basically wheel-sucked on him all the way round and got the better of him late on. I think Persian King, you know, obviously he pulls hard in mile races, so he probably needs a good gallop to go at. Give him a good gallop to go at, get him over a mile two, and I think we could see even more from him. The only time in his career he's really flopped, Scott Burton's telling me, he's been at all the meetings where Persian King's run this year, and tells me, I think, essentially, he's been as fat as a bull up until recently. Now, obviously, at Deauville, he was beaten. That was heavier than heavy. That's what a Scottish person would call glor at Deauville the day. We've got, in Scotland, they have to make up a word for muddier than muddy. Obviously, it's Scotland. So, yeah, that's the term you'd use for what happened at Deauville. It was just horrendous ground. And there's a good case for saying we're only just seeing what Persian King's capable of, and that he could be even better over a mile two. And if that is indeed the case, and I hope he does go for the Champion Stake at Ascot, he could be a massive runner in that.
Yeah, he certainly could. And interestingly, that, you know, it was put to Andre Farb about the Arc. He's still in there. Personally, I'm not convinced whether a mile and a half will necessarily be his bag, but I'd certainly love to see him in a Champion Stakes. So what price did you go for that race on Champion Stakes at Ascot, Binners?
7-1 from 16-1, Maddie. We've also got him in the Arc betting. Whether he'll step up to a mile and a half, we'll have to see. 25 from 33. But quite interesting, Andre Farb saying that he thinks he's one of the best milers in Europe, and he's still thinking of stepping him up in Trip in the Champion Stakes. So I would expect a very big run from him at Ascot.
Ben, have they got a run through of the Champion Stakes market there? Because I think it's shaping up to be a slyly fascinating race.
I have indeed, Keith. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. At the head of the market, Gayar for Mishriff, we can't separate them, 5-2. And it's 6 Lord North for Magical and Love as well. 7-1 Persian King and 8-1 Bar. But yeah, it could be an absolute crackerjack, Keith.
And news this morning that, however, Pile Driver runs in the St. Ledger, he's going to allegedly run in it as well. So that's just another top-class horse to add to the race. Let's talk about the race with you, Lee, the Prix de Moulin then. Do you think, it's tough, the Pinatubo argument, isn't it? Because understandably, a lot of people will be thinking he should have won the race, but he was ridden like that for a reason. And you can understand why James Doyle was riding him as cold as he was. What did you take out of the race?
He's an enigma of a horse, isn't he, really? I mean, in some ways, his performance in defeat on Sunday, was the most exciting thing he's done this year. And that's not to belittle his achievements. You know, he was a group winner over seven furlongs in Deauville. He ran big races in the Guineas at Royal Ascot. But the ground he made up the Longchamp home straight, was incredibly eye-catching and just, again, left you thinking, you know, what can this horse do? How good is he? And for me, he's a head-scratcher. Clearly, as James Doyle, I think, implied on in his post-race quotes, he's a horse that maybe they weren't convinced would excel in a lung-bursting mile race. They rode him from off the pace. The race went against him and didn't quite play out. But if he had got up and won, we'd have been saying that was an incredible winning performance, as it was. He was still almost two lengths off Pershing King at the line. Like Keith, I completely agree. The Breeders' Cup Mile looks like it's going to be the obvious race for him. And yet, even if he wins there, he still needs to produce an astonishing display if he's actually going to match his figures from his two-year-old days. It seems to be very similar to Too Darn Hot last year, who was a Group 1 winner at three without ever actually producing a performance to match his best efforts at two. There's loads of brilliance in Pinatubo, but he's sort of hamstrung by how good he was at two, because whatever he does this year seems a slight anticlimax, which seems a horribly unfair thing to say about a horse who is extremely good.
Yeah, definitely. I thought it was fascinating that they added him into the sprint on Champions Day. I mean, that clearly shows that they're unsure about this mile trip. And like you say, I think the tight turns and the fast pace of the race in America should suit him. But that was a really interesting chapter to the Pinatubo story, I thought, going forward. Surely they won't run him on Champions Day in that sprint. I mean, that would be fantastic, wouldn't it? Go on, Keith.
I've lost my train of thought now, to be honest, Mary.
Where would you like to see him? Would you rather see him at the Breeders' Cup or rather see him in a sprint race over six?
Oh, it'd be great to see him in a sprint race. I think he should go for the Breeders' Cup Mile. It's a race that's made for him and he will win it. So I think he should definitely be aiming at that. What I was going to say, actually, was that I very much agreed with Lee's assessment that that was a first time Sunday. That was even though he got beaten, that was the first time I thought, oh yeah, he is as good this year as he was last, out of the whole season, and it was him getting beat. So that tells you a little bit about the performance. And I think as well, the fact that he is like Too Darn Hot and that he hasn't improved on his two-year-old form, but if he can match it, which I think Too Darn Hot technically did it on RPRs without looking, I think he matched his two-year-old form and didn't better it. As in terms of a stud value, I don't think that'll hurt him at all, really. A horse that excelled at two and repeated it at three isn't going to be hurt. In the old days, 10 years ago even, you know, a horse that improved from two to three would have to be necessary in order to really see its stock as something that desirable. But now, just holding that form is probably enough. So if he
Do you think he was sort of over-egged as a two-year-old, or do you think he was that good? Do you think people got a bit carried away last year?
A little, but not... What was arrived at for, say, his ratings and whatnot was not beyond the bounds of plausibility, really. People just put him towards the top end of what, you know, any rating is like a distribution of, you know, most horses could get rated 3 or 4 pounds either side of a middle point. And most of the time you handicap them on the middle point. But with horses like Pinatubo, a lot of people just moved him subtly towards the top end of it. And I think that's what happened. He was an exceptional two-year-old, probably a better two-year-old than Too Darn Hot, and just hasn't improved on it any, because he was at that age in his career forward enough to do it. So, as I say, he won't suffer a stud for it. And, you know, we still do get excited and think these horses will kick on when they get to three and whatnot, but it might not be the reality anymore, to be quite honest with you. It's not what people are looking for anymore. So we might see a bit less of it. We might see a bit more of horses like him and horses like Too Darn Hot. But it's one of these things that the time will tell.
Yeah, it certainly will. But you're very confident that he can win that Breeders' Cup Mile. I wonder if any of our panellists have any confident selections on this weekend's St. Ledger? We'll find out shortly.
Paddy Power are now offering free streaming on all UK and Irish horse racing. No bet required. Just log in and watch.
Welcome back to this final instalment of this Monday postcast. Now, let's preview the Potemps St. Ledger, the final classic, which takes place this Saturday. And at the head of the market, who do we have, Binners?
Well, we've got Pile Driver and Santiago, Maddie. Once again, a market we can't separate. They're both 11-4 joint favourites. We did favour Santiago slightly this morning, so Pile Driver's come into favouritism. Now, Keith's selection, who we'll hear more about later, Huckham, he's 4-1, 7-1 Galileo Chrome, who one person on the panel has got a huge price about, 12-1 Subjectivist, and it's 14-1 Bar.
I like that, Binners. I like that very much. I'll be in a right mess if he doesn't indeed get supplemented. But I did blow blow the Galileo Chrome horn on this show last week. But let's go to Keith then. I know you're a big Hookham fan, Keith. I mean, it's all been quite straightforward for him this season, hasn't it? I mean, what have you seen from him that makes you think he's going to be a better horse for this race than the likes of Pile Driver and Santiago?
Part of it is based on, you know, we've all been talking most of the season about how ordinary these three-year-olds might be. And it might be a bit harsh because of the circumstances we find ourselves in with the way the season's panned out. You know, we looked at the Gordon Stakes at Goodwood and said, oh, these, they're just beating each other. And then Pile Driver's obviously won the Voltigeur very impressively and rightfully taken his place near the top of the betting gear. But remember, it is only those horses, those same horses that he's beating. Hookham has form with older horses. He won that that race at Newbury extremely well. He'd come there directly from handicaps, having won the King George V at Royal Ascot. Kipps has improved, who was second that day, has improved again since then. It's just really good form. That was only his third run. Newbury only his fourth. This is just a horse that's improving so, so quickly. Already has form that's virtually on a par with anything in the race, having never run in so much as a group two, let alone a group one. I just think he's got so much more potential to go past them and should be favourite, really.
Okay, that's an interesting stance, isn't it? I mean, we're still waiting to see Serpentine. I mean, that would be the real sort of cherry on top on finding out how good these three-year-olds are, wouldn't it? But alas.
I might have said this on the postcast before, but wouldn't be at all surprised if I never see Serpentine again.
Yeah. Do you think it'll be a similar, I mean, Wings of Eagles, he was injured, wasn't he? But do you think that they're just going to sort of keep him under wraps now? Or,
well, you don't have to open the mystery box, do you?
I like that very much. Lee,
I'm not in the Serpentine fan club as such, although, you know, I think, you know, thrilling Derby win, but I think they were talking about that going on Sunday, weren't they, for the Grand Prix de Paris on Art Charles Cup. You know, would normally be the Prix Niel, but this year is the Grand Prix de Paris. That's the race they've been talking about for him. So
they could bump into English King there.
Yeah, who's been left in the ledger. But of course, they won't get Frank in the ledger, but they might get him in the Grand Prix de Paris, which I'm going to keep calling the Prix Niel all week, in the Grand Prix de Paris.
Okay, Lee, if I gave you a tenner, who would you put it on for the St. Ledger?
I prefer you just give me a tenner, and then and I'll invest it as I wish, Maddie. I think it's actually a strong St. Ledger. Like he says, they're not a vintage middle distance bunch, the 3-year olds. This is certainly 3-year old colts. I think we've got one exceptional horse in Love, who's a filly. I'm a storyteller, that's my job, and the story I would most like to tell, actually there's two stories I'd like to tell. I think Hookham would be a great story, probably won't get Keith's investment in the intro, that's lovely as it is. I think Owen Burrows is a really good guy, he's had a fantastic season, and him winning the St. Ledger and Jim Crowley winning his first classic would be a great story. But I think in terms of storytelling, Pile Driver is the obvious one. You know, he's a horse that people didn't want as a yearling. He represents connections that aren't accustomed to winning these sort of races. Martin Dwyer's won a Derby, he's won an Oaks, but certainly William Muir is not a trainer who's accustomed to having classic winners. The horse flopped it in the Derby, But the more you watch that Great Voltage Stakes, admittedly, this wasn't a fantastic Great Voltage Stakes, and you can run a bus through the form, but he's cruised into that race and then won it as easy as he could have wished to do so, giving £3 to everything in the field. This almost sounds like a weird thing to say, but I think the danger is that William Muir has a horse who has too much brilliance to win a St. Ledger. You just wonder whether he will be better over a mile and a quarter, mile and a half, than a mile and six. If he stays the trip, I think he should have too many gears for them. But it's clearly an if. Aidan O'Brien's bringing across, by the looks of it, the first, second and third from a really substandard Irish derby. But Santiago seems to have run a decent race against Stradivarius in the Goodwood Cup. We've got your horse, Maddie, Galileo Chrome, who's looked really exciting in his three starts this season. We may have English King if he doesn't go to France. It's a good St. Ledger. It's a good St. Ledger, and hopefully the St. Ledger with spectators there to watch it will be not in their usual numbers. And in that sense, it will be a rarity. It'll be the first really big race stage in Britain this year with anything resembling a proper crowd.
Mm. And just speaking of a crowd, I think, sorry, Keith, I'll come back to you in just a second. Yeah. A proper crowd at Doncaster for the St. Ledger. I mean, there's been, you know, I think the mayor came out of Doncaster and said she wasn't necessarily happy with the decision for this pilot to go ahead. I mean, what are you going to be looking at from sort of a perspective going forward? What are you going to be hoping to see? I mean, we all hope it goes smoothly because this is a massive step, isn't it, Lee?
Yeah, I mean, it is a massive step, Maddie. And that what you said there about going smoothly, I think that has to be the main wish, that there are no reasons for anyone during the course of the 4 days at Donny or in the days thereafter to question why it took place. I think I'm hoping that people go to Doncaster this week will go there with the right mindset. As someone who's been fortunate to do a lot of horse racing on race courses this year, I can say with absolute certainty it is not racing as we would normally know it. The action on the track is the same, but race courses aren't the same. There's limited movement, and that will be the case for race goers. They'll find themselves, I'd imagine, in almost like pen areas, and you're limited to that pen. But it's a start and it's progress. And if we're going to get back to where we were a few months ago in the quickest possible time, we need these stepping stones to get there. This is the next really big stepping stone, and we will find that things will get better and better and better until the point where we are back to normal. We're not that close to the moment, sadly, but this will get us that bit closer.
And I'm sure we'll learn an awful lot from it, which is the main thing. As you say, we need to get people back on race courses for the good of the sport, really. Keith, sorry, I'll go back to you.
Yeah, so it was actually more about the form and horses I was talking about, unsurprisingly.
That's fine.
So it's Lee's absolutely correct in not wanting Lugubrious Old Me to write his intros for him, but he does hit it. I thought the point he made about Pile Driver and Hookham was something I was actually going to bring up during when we were talking about the Mulan, is that how much has this race and this story been improved by having a horse by William Muir prominent for the St. Ledger, having a horse trained by Owen Burrows prominent for the St. Ledger. In the middle distance category, the milers have saved the season, I think. I don't know what the panel think. The mile division's been really, really interesting and consistently so because there are a broader spectrum and a more widely representative number of stables with all the top horses, you know. With the Derby and the middle distance horses, there's a lot of Gosden, a lot of O'Brien, some Appleby, not a lot else. You know, with top milers, you've got one Gosden, you've got one Appleby, you've got one O'Brien, yes. But you've also got Farber, you've also got Andrew Balding, you had Marcus Tregoning, Gerard Lyons. And I think racing, the St. Ledger showing, as the Mulan and the Milers generally this season have, how much you benefit from having a wider representation among the connections involved.
Yeah, definitely. I think we'd all be in agreement with that, wouldn't we? You know, competition and that competition being spread out and less of a monopoly is fantastic. But we've given you plenty of food for thought there on the St. Ledger. But let's talk about the Irish Champions weekend then coming up. I mean, it's going to be a fantastic build up this week to those two feature events. And the big one is the Irish Champion Stakes. It looks as if Gaeth is going to take his place. Then we have Magical, we have Alpine Star, Lord North, Fancy Blue, etc., who could be turning up against him. Keith, I mean, obviously a lot of people are going to be looking at this race, but do you have any thoughts? Who would be your sort of nap of the weekend? Is there anything that you're really looking forward to seeing?
Hookham is a horse I'm keenest on this weekend. I'm sitting in Paul Keighley's chair on Friday, and the only way I won't be putting up Hookham in that column is due to price if he gets really short. But the Irish Champion Stakes, Alpine Star, still a horse I really want to see given more of a chance at a mile two. I think she's a really good horse. And it might be unfortunate she runs into Gaeth, but she might test him more than the odds imply. I think she's still very exciting.
Okay, Alpine Star then for Keith. I mean, she's been fantastic this season, hasn't she? Winning that Coronation Stakes and then finishing second in the Dian and second behind Palace Pier last time out. That was a good run. Lee, what are you most looking forward to at Leopardstown and the Curragh then?
The Irish Champion Stakes is clearly the main draw. I think as Keith was saying earlier on, I would suspect that Gaeth will be going here and won't be going to the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe. I think that's logical for him, but it should be another fantastic race. I would be surprised if Lord North can't get closer to him. I love the way he won at Royal Ascot, and I was a bit disappointed with him at York last time. So I would hope he can get close to Gaeth, but he's clearly not as talented an athlete as Gaeth is. Very, very, very few horses could claim to be. But the whole 2 days, wonderful racing. This year's all five of the races on Sunday are broadcast on ITV, so they'll go to a bigger audience, which is great. The National Stakes should provide a tremendous encounter between Godolphin and Ballydore, Master of the Seas and Battleground. They both look really good in their group races so far this term. I'm looking forward to their showdown on Sunday.
Yeah, just the four group ones on Sunday. Sorry, go on, Keith.
Is Battleground definitely running? Because I would have expected him to be favourite.
Oh, okay, you think he's not going to go there?
Well, I don't know. I have no inside track on this at all. I saw Master of Sea 9-4, Battleground 5-2, and thought Battleground might be a certain runner, because I assume he'd be the favourite if they were both guaranteed 100% runners.
Mm. Well, do you know who would know more about it? Bookmakers hear about things like that.
Well, yes.
They certainly do. Binners, any steer on that particular clash?
Well, it is interesting. Master of the Seas heads the market at 9-4. Maddie, we were 11-4, and Battleground, we were 3-1 him. But it might actually not just be about the two horses. Lucky Vega has looked very, very good as well, and he's 11-4, and it's 8-1 Barb. But let's hope all three of those, plus a few more interesting ones like Jesse Harrington's Cadillac, turn up, and we're in for a super 2-year-old race.
We certainly are. We're in for a real treat this weekend, aren't we? Well, there's been something for everyone on this show. So thank you all for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. Bruce and the team will be back on Friday, I believe. So they'll be previewing all the big weekend action then. So make sure to tune into that. And thanks for joining me, gents. Have a wonderful week.
Paddy Power Games has over 250 of your favourites to play online, and we're going to attempt to name them all in this 10-second ad before the T's and C's kick in. There's Blackjack, 18+, begambleaware.org.